Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and today is a Mother's Day show. Yesterday was Mother's Day. I have some moms in the studio, and there will be one more soon. And before I introduce them, I'm going to read part of Julia Ward Howe, who's a poet in the late 1800s, her proclamation that partially inspired the creation of Mother's Day as an anti-war holiday. Arise, then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be of water or of tears, say firmly, we will not have questions answered by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands will not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, the women of one country, will be too tender to those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the voice of a devastated earth, a voice goes up with its own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe our dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. So, just to set the tone, I'm going to welcome two guests who have both been on the show at one point or another, some in the deep past, but I'm here with Liz Moore and Erica Prince-Simons, and then we'll be joined by Cicely Thompson in just a bit. She's on her way doing mom things, which is the theme. So I thought it would be cool to invite some of the rad moms that I know who are involved in politics and activism and organizing in all of those things to talk about all manner of things. So hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I don't know if you guys each want to just introduce yourself a little bit sure. About who you are in terms of what you do, but also just more broadly than that.
Sure. This is Liz, and I'm the director of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane, which is a 43-year-old membership-based organization. Our mission is to build a just and nonviolent world, and our approach to that work is to engage everyday people in community organizing and grassroots leadership development for peace, economic justice, racial justice, and human rights. And we do that because we are united by the belief that everyday people have the power to accomplish extraordinary things together. And outside of work, I still am Liz Moore, but I also am a mom of two boys, 7 and 13, and grew up here and live on my family's farm north of town.
Awesome. Thanks.
I'm Erica. I'm a marketing communications specialist. I just own my own business, and I kind of do that part-time while part-time caring for my 16-month-old. And I am on the board for River City Youth Ops, which is an urban farming program in the West Central community that gives youth opportunities to do leadership training and educational curriculum around food justice and job training and all kinds of cool stuff so they can go on to have bright futures.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm glad. I've known both of you for years, and it's been cool to see you suddenly become a mom and then like to see your kids grow up, Liz. Mm-hmm. It's really rad as someone who's not a mom. Yeah. I'm glad that I know people who have kids so I can get like just the right dose.
That's right.
Of
right.
Other people's kids. That's just not
yeah, and then
a
leave
thing in my life
want.
Right now.
Taylor's yeah. primary role in my child's life is teaching her to dance.
Yes, that is also true. Yes. Yeah. So I don't know if people saw, shameless plug, I finally made an Instagram for the show. It's at Praxis Radio. It's also linked to facebook.com/Praxis Radio. And I made a post that is 8 different moms that
that's
I like.
Great.
I don't know if you saw it or not, but do either of you have a favorite, like, inspirational, specifically maybe politics-y or activist-y mom who you think of?
For me, I was really struck by the image of Dolores Huerta that you have there. When I was an intern at Pagels, we hosted her to speak here in Spokane in support of farmworker organizing that was happening in Central Washington at the time. And she shared a story there. She has 13 kids, I believe. And she shared a story of one day. So she always encouraged the members of the Farmworkers Union to come to bring their kids to meetings, because when people organize, it's heroic, and kids should witness their parents as heroes. And she shared a story about her little girl who was 2 or 3 at the time, and they were in the strategy meeting, and the little girl had one of those little phones, and she was like practicing dialing it and making lots of phone calls. And after the meeting, they sort of said, "Oh, she's so cute, honey. Who are you calling? Or what are you doing?" And she said, "I'm calling the people." And then they were like, "Oh, what are you calling them to do? Are you calling them to picket?" And the little girl said, "No, they're not ready to picket. I'm calling them to leaflet." And so she's a role model to me in terms of living her own life and doing her own organizing work, and also fully welcoming her kids into that life. And I just think it's important, not only because people should see that we can organize and we can witness that. And, you know, I grew up with very community involved parents and put away a lot of chairs after meetings and waited around for my parents to be done talking, just like my kids have to do. And I think it's important to just be for kids to just be part of the life of a community in that way, because it allows parents to be part of the life in a community in a different way. And also there's this amazing benefit that then they soak up everything that they're in the room with. And that little girl reached a level of strategic understanding that many adults don't ever have the opportunity to get to. And she was only 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. My answer is less impressive, but I did not plan to become a parent. So I have zero like role models that I sought out. Since my child came through the foster care system, she was with actually another family before she lived with us. And the person who had her she has 5 of her own kids, 2 of whom, which are adopted, and 3 of her own. And she just always has like 20 kids in her house. I don't know how, but so she kind of was the person to mentor me as I was figuring out how to be a parent. And she's in Coeur d'Alene, but she does a lot of activism around getting people to engage with the foster care system and engage with kids who, especially, I mean, everywhere, but in Idaho, they're dealing with a pretty epic crisis opioid epidemic, which is then turning into an epidemic of like children being in the system and not having anywhere to go. And it's, I feel like I'm just gonna die, like keeping one child alive. And she's like, "I have all these children and I'm gonna take more foster children, and then I'm gonna go do like barbecues and picnics for other foster parents and like recruit people." And she's like, "How?" And then we also have there's a woman in Spokane who's kind of doing the same thing, and she's actually watching my child right now while she also has like her own foster kids and her own kids. And I'm just like blown away that they can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I look up to them, and I will never be them.
Also,
okay.
shout out to all the moms, but also shout out to all of the secondary caretakers, right. Whoever right. they may be, the nannies of the world, and babysitters union.
And the dads who just are full-on dads and don't have to ever be thought of as babysitters.
Of course, yeah. They'll be here in June.
That's right. Their month is coming soon.
Bringing some dads in June. So mine... I learned about a couple. Well, I learned about one new one because I was reading about different radical moms, and I learned about Wilma Mankiller, who's the first female chief of the Cherokee Nation. And she was also a single mom at the time that she reached that position, which was in the early 80s. And she basically just became an activist because she saw the occupation of Alcatraz by Native Americans. And she was like, "Well, this is great. What next?" And just kind of from just seeing that from afar. So I learned more about her. And I also learned that Josephine Baker, who was, you know, a spy more than an activist, but also an amazing entertainer and performer and singer, was a single mom of, I think, 3 during the height of her fame. So it was just kind of like all of these people who you learn about everything they did and then learn that they were also... Mm-hmm. having children, wow. which I feel the way you feel, where
right, like how do you even find your shoes?
Yeah. We can do a you've been at it longer, so maybe you can tell her.
I mean, I keep them right by the door. You develop systems. I actually reached a moment on Saturday where both my kids had a friend over, and I experienced that thing that moms of lots of kids talk about, where you just sort of hit the point where suddenly, like, adding more children actually made less work for me, because they were guests, so right. There's that. But also, like, I just sat in the living room and drank my coffee, and, like, the older kids went this way and the younger kids went this way, and then they traded, and they were just switching off who was in the Lego room and who was outside, and it was like the angels were singing. There were four kids at my house, and I didn't have to do anything for a while. But it's not like that when they're 16 months. No. I mean, it's like, yeah. I remember when Magnus turned one and somebody said to me, oh, he's one. You're out of the pit. And I said, yeah, that's right. That first year is just, it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's really, really hard. And our stupid romanticism of how we're supposed to savor every moment, like, not every moment is something to be savored. Some moments are just ones to get through.
Right.
So you can go to sleep soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which actually leads right into what I wanted to ask you, which is, like, what do you, I think obviously there's an imbalance. It's like you just mentioned dads when we were talking about other mm-hmm. caretakers, and there's an imbalance, I think, in what's expected of mothers versus fathers. But also just, you know, women in general, I think, wearing a lot of hats mm-hmm. and, you know, quote unquote, having it all. So what do you think, what have you experienced as our expectation of mothers in society?
I feel like I've experienced, I mean, A, the expectation that we all want to be mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, that was always true for me. But also the idea that, I was thinking about this yesterday, thinking about this show, there's this idea that, like, we become, as a mother, my activism is about my children. And it's not really true for me. I was an activist for years and an organizer for years before I had kids. And I think being a mother has strengthened my organizing skills mm-hmm. because there have been a lot of car rides where we hear something on Democracy Now! And then they have questions about it, which sometimes means I don't listen to Democracy Now! Because there's a lot of death in that newscast, and I don't necessarily need my 7-year-old yet to be there, but we have a lot of great conversations, and it's a good organizing challenge to boil it down, to be able to talk about, you know, racial disproportionality with my son who was 11 at the time. And I said, well, do you understand? He said, he asked me if I thought Kathy McMorris Rogers was racist. And I said, well, that word can mean a lot of things. That word can mean that a white person thinks that they're better than a person of color. And I don't know if she believes that or not. But that word can also mean policies that hurt people of color. And I said to him, do you know what disproportionality means? And he goes, yeah, it's disproportionate. All right, 11-year-old, like, why don't you come teach some workshops about this concept that many adults actively resist trying to get? So I feel like it's improved my organizing to be a mom, because I have to boil it down. And, you know, our first picket line, he said, what those guys doing, mama? And I said, well, we're using our words to say that everyone, that the bosses should share and be fair and be respectful. And it was a really great crystallization of what we're generally doing down into the terms that, like, are kindergarten level or below. But it's not. I feel like it is a really essentialist idea that I'm an activist because I have babies.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of my
life.
You
wanted a better world for yourself.
Right. Yes, I would, like, right now also. And also for all the people who are adults mm-hmm. and, you know, and it's that very old idea in American culture that is how middle class white women were able to make space for themselves in the public sphere by bringing the private sphere, by bringing their role in the private sphere to the public through the motherhood
mm-hmm.
halo and getting to assert that. So there's some strategy to it, and many organizations use it very well. But I just think it needs to be obviously understood as a strategy and not as the entire thing that mm-hmm. any of us are.
Yeah. What about you?
So the question was, what do I see as expectations for what it means?
Yeah.
Well, what's been really striking for me is the, like, from other women, the thing of, well, having children has taught me the real meaning of sacrifice.
Mm.
Like, the kind of conflation of not meeting your own needs with being able to care for another person. That just, as a person who's done a lot of kind of self-work around, you know, not feeling guilty for taking care of my own needs, I'm like, what? It just, you know, so then I, you know, I feel like I'm a bad parent if I want to take a bath or something. And I'm just like, I mean, obviously, I do take baths. I do take care of myself. But I am clean.
I'm sitting right by you, and I smell nice. Totally fine.
Yeah, so just that whole thing of how do you, where's, and then a lot of parenting literature is kind of around that. Like, if you are not nurturing your child around the clock, speaking 2,000 words to your child every hour, engaging with them in play, like, it's like just taking care of what you need to take care of, even if what you're taking care of is getting dinner ready for later or cleaning the dishes that they have dirtied. Like, there's mm-hmm. guilt around every action you take, because if you're just engaging with your child, or I'm just talking about my experience, I guess, mm-hmm. but I hear this from other people too, just that it's very difficult for me to be present and just feel like whatever I'm doing is enough. Even when objectively I know I'm doing a fine job. And I wrote kind of a long Facebook post that could just be summed up in like the sound of a pterodactyl about like all these posts I saw on Facebook yesterday about everyone just being like, well, you know, not all superheroes wear capes. And I just like admire my wife's like patience and like just all the kind of like, I see my wife doing stuff that I know is like impossible to do and not go completely insane. And I'm just going to choose to like compliment her about it instead of actually,
rather than take on roughly 50% of those extra tasks.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't seem to me like keeping 1 to 3 children, let's say, alive should be like Sylvia Plath level crazy making, you know, but it is, because it's lonely, because you'd feel, even if you have a partner, you feel like you have to parent them as well in order to get them to just pull some of the weight. And I'm not talking about my partner in particular. I'm just talking about our culture and the work that you have to do with your partner just to get to the point of feeling like you're in an equitable place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that kind of loops back to, that's something that's kept me. I've never really just had a strong desire to have children. I appreciate you bringing that up. I like them. I like caretaking for other people's children, etc. But I like being an aunt a lot. But I think that part of my hesitation has always been around the way that community operates or doesn't operate in our culture as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty confident that if I lived in Spokane, Washington forever and had the excellent community I have here, I would have a lot of help. But it's, like you said, hard to ask for help. There's all of this pressure. So what do you think the role of, have you had a positive experience of the role of community in your own experience? And also, like, how can we do that for each other?
When I came back here after college, I lived in a house with a bunch of other people. It was, those people included a kid who was 3 and a half when I moved in. And he's like out of college now. He's very old. And but anyway, he was little. And what was so great is that I saw from the kind of the aunt perspective how good it was for him to have all these adults around, so he could go, like, he could do Legos with one of us, and then he could like cook with me or work in the garden with somebody else. And it was this great like surround sound, and his parents had built-in relief to some extent. And it was so great for him to have all this different kinds of stimulation, and his parents didn't have to, where they weren't in charge of all 2,000 words per hour getting spoken to him, you know? And So that was a great experience that is very counter to the kind of single family housing model that is the norm. And, you know, for a lot of the time here, I've lived across the yard from my parents. And so they're extremely generous and willing to be and eager to be part of their grandchildren's lives. But I think that, well, and some of that I've actually found through social media. There's a marvelous secret mother's Facebook group that I'm in that that where people are like, mommies, this is what happened today. What do I do? And then people can kind of problem solve with each other or just like commiserate or compliment each other's babies or whatever, you know. So there's some ways that social media, I think, can play a good role because maybe you are just all by yourself in the house and that's what's practical, but you can still feel somewhat connected. But it's a real need. I mean, it's not, you know, evolutionarily, it's not. The single family housing situation is by far an aberration for humans. And there's some good stuff around privacy and so forth, but there's also some stuff that comes with that around the likelihood of feeling isolated, let alone not being able to afford childcare, right, or not having the kind of funding for childcare supports that we really need in order to make sure that all families have equal access to incredibly high quality, you know, early childhood development that isn't just a warehouse or just a playing time, although that's incredibly valuable too. And I do think that there's, going back to what you're saying around the standards of like constantly educational parenting, I would extol the value of allowing kids to be bored, because if they're bored and there's art supplies nearby, or, you know, it's what the Montessori world would call, I think, the prepared environment, where the environment does some of the parenting alongside you. And there's been some magnificent, you know, games created, like literally physically game boards built when I was busy and they had to, you know, they had to handle the being many. I mean, you all are creative people, you know, I'm sure for me, like the sense of boredom is actually a stage in the creative process that can't be skipped or replicated.
Well, and shout out to my mom, who people are always asking, like, were your parents activists? Like, did you? And like, they just let us do whatever we wanted, for better or for worse. I mean, that's an oversimplification. But my mom would always say, from the time I was really little, I always remember her saying, well, only boring people get bored. And it was so harsh. It was just like, oh, well, crap, I don't want to be boring. I better figure out something to do.
Right.
And
right.
So I read every book.
I don't think you turned out boring.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
You got that.
Yeah.
That
what's your take on the whole community question? And also, can you be slightly closer to that microphone?
I can be slightly closer to
the
microphone. Perfect.
Thank you.
Moving the microphone. So I've actually had people approach me and offer to take care of my child. Like these two people that I've talked about, the two other foster parents who just have been like, I know what it's like, you need help, send your kid over. If there was one time when I was actually like losing it, just so not in a place where I could handle any more of, I, you know, just like normal baby stuff like teething and cold and being a human being also independently that has their own problems and struggles and whatever. And I just like dropped her off at her original foster mom's house for a weekend, and they just like played with her all weekend and were like, we'll see you Tuesday. It was like so great. And so that has been really nice, just having people who kind of recognize what it's like, or like I've had women come up to me who I don't know and just be like, I just want you to know that everybody thinks about shaking their baby. And it's okay, just as long as you don't shake your baby. like just women in general are like, yeah, I know exactly where you're at just because I see the size of your child. And I know, I remember what it was like when my children were that size. So that's just like really cool to have women in general be really supportive of what it feels like. I actually have a really I have a struggle with the mommy group thing, which is super frustrating for me because all the mothers I know, I love and respect a lot. And I wish I had the kind of willingness to seek support. But I think because of kind of being gender non-binary and not really associating motherhood with like my identity, or even womanhood, it's horrifying to me to think of being in a room full of people who potentially in a room full of people who are like, all I ever wanted was to be a mother. Cause mm-hmm. I just don't, which I just know is not what mothers actually are. Like mother, I mean, some are, but it's like a whole lot of people choose to reproduce for different reasons. But I just kind of have like a fear around that that's kept me from seeking out things that would probably be very healthy and good for me, like co-op childcare and, you know, yada, yada.
I mean, yeah. I think it's really iffy. I mean, I think you don't know until you get in the room. I don't think you're, right. I mean, I want to be like, no, don't go in. But I feel like your concerns are, they play out. I mean, I see that. And it's, and I do think generally it's really nice to be, especially when my kids were younger and I just was trying to sit in a coffee shop and like think my own thoughts for two continuous minutes and couldn't do that. I just remember when my oldest was born and you know, I was like so in love with him and all the oxytocin was just totally, you know, high, like postpartum and I loved him. And there was also a part of me after a week where I was like, okay, this is great. I'm ready to go sit in a coffee shop by myself for a while. And in my head, obviously I knew he was my child, but there was also this part of me that was sort of waiting for the parents to come back and get this beautiful baby. And then I would go do some other stuff and then come back for a while. And, you know, that's not how that works. And it was really hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my husband was extremely engaged and, I mean, it even feels insulting to refer to him as being extremely engaged. He's a full-on dad, just at the same time that I'm a full-on mom. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we were both in that. Like, I don't feel like there is enough understanding of how incredibly rough that postpartum part is, that adjustment to being the parent of an infant is. I had read in my own typical style, I had done like two birth prep series of workshops and read 10 books about labor. And I was super into pregnancy. And I used to want to be a midwife at one point. So it was like a fascinating experience from that sort of scientific perspective. And emotionally and physically, it was just fascinating. And then labor. And I had a very positive childbirth experience both times. And then there's this infant who not only doesn't know what the heck's going on either, also has no motor control at all. And oh my gosh, there was a day where I came out and found the peanut butter jar in the fridge with the jam lid on it and the jam jar in the cupboard with the peanut butter lid on it. And that was the reality of parenting.
The wake up call.
Yeah. That's how it was for a long time.
Well, and like when I thought that I was going to be able to like schedule 10 hours of childcare a week and then like do 10 hours of work during that time.
Oh, yeah. It's a great idea.
Yeah, no.
In theory. Yeah.
Right.
Like the two, maybe.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis, we're having a little roundtable on motherhood in the movement, I guess, as it relates to like having the rest of your life. And all of that. Unfortunately, our third mom, who is a dear friend of mine, is just completely stuck at work right now and then has to pick up her 6-year-old from childcare. So shout out to Cicely. She'll be back. She's been here before. But yeah. But I think we can easily manage with all of us. I wanted to circle back to something you just said, Erica, around gender and, you know, being non-binary, and I think that we're finally getting to a point where we're starting to question our concepts of gender, and especially kind of, I guess, what would be called like traditional femininity is wearing away in some ways and being really aggressively questioned. I don't know. What do you think that's I guess I have hope that that might crack open notions of motherhood also and parenthood, I guess, mm-hmm. to be more accurate. I don't know. What do y'all think about that?
I have a funny story for you.
I'm ready.
So I went to Florida with my sister, who looks like a girl. And we basically look like twins, except for that she looks like a girl and I look like a boy with, you know, girl body parts. Sure. And we had to take my baby to the ER. She's fine. Everything's fine. But, like, every doctor and nurse and person who came and talked to us just, like, spoke to her, regardless of who was holding the baby. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was just like, excuse me. Like, first of all, we're twins. We're not actually twins, but we mm-hmm. look like we, I know that's a thing with lesbians, but it's like haircuts and stuff. It's mm-hmm. not like you actually just are related.
No, yeah.
Like, we're
yeah.
visibly related.
Yes.
And I am the mother and she is the aunt. So anyway, that was just like, we laughed. Huh. It was the only thing there was to laugh about at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I think it might've been funnier to us at the time. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think just, like, the idea that, like, women have certain innate qualities that make them better mothers. Maybe I just don't experience that also because I did not birth her, so I don't have actually, like, the chemical mm-hmm. stuff that I think goes on. I don't know, that I was promised. yeah, and, like, my husband is actually, like, a very nurturing person, and that is just not something about my personality at all. I think I'm nice and good at caring for my child, but we're just different in that way, and I don't think that makes him more feminine. It just makes him a really good parent. But what I carry around is a lot of kind of like just comparing myself to other people or feeling like I'm not doing it right or that I'm not that I'm broken somehow, like I'm not capable of doing it, which is just like really unfortunate because I'm not a bad parent. I am a good mm-hmm. parent. I would be a really good dad. I would be considered an excellent dad, right?
That's so bizarre.
But I'm like but I'm not performing motherhood correctly. So I think mm-hmm. like the more that we can kind of decouple gender from the roles in parenting and let people just kind of choose their roles based on what their strengths are, it's going to look very different and you have different things to offer your child mm-hmm. because you just are different human beings. But I really just haven't, I don't think I've ever talked to a mother who hasn't talked to me about their guilt. And that just like really, it's like that's just so much of parenting and so much of it is this role that we've been given by a system that was not created for us. And that was specifically created to oppress us. And then like our attachment to performing to that role so that the people who did create the system will see us as valuable and successful at what we're doing. And that, I mean, I think that's actually harmful to your relationship with your child because then you're making it about you and like the performance of parenting versus just like, hey, what does my kid need? Can I do that for them?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my screen went to screensaver. Yeah, it's and then I guess it's related to that and something I think about a lot. Because I have some people in my family, a couple people in my family who are stay at home moms and love it. And that's what they've wanted to do for that's genuinely like, this is what I want to do is take care of my kids and make sure they have the best childhood they can have. And like, that is genuinely super fulfilling to me. And I think that's awesome. But as you were saying, that's not, you know, fulfilling to everyone. That sounds scary to me, knowing that I'm straight up not a nurturing person, as you were saying, mm-hmm. Try to care for people. I've successfully kept houseplants alive for like more than 2 years at this point, which is a big benchmark. But what do you think, I mean, how do you think we can celebrate in general the role of moms or parents without like reducing women into that role? Like, where's the balance there?
I think that it kind of, the thing that comes to my mind actually goes back to what you were saying, Erica, about the sort of celebration of motherhood as sacrifice. We have to identify that as a problem. That would be a step in that direction and crush it or burn it or whatever. And So that means that we can't just celebrate. People actually have to pitch in, mm-hmm. in the way that I've experienced, like kind of you were referring to, like mothers who have, whose kids are now older, and they look back and they don't just think about like, oh, every moment's so precious. Like they actually remember that like some moments are not at all precious and are incredibly difficult. And even just, you know, being in the grocery store with two hungry kids, just having some eye contact and a smile from another parent, that you can tell that like, okay, like that just gives me a moment of perspective for just a second. Mm-hmm. Or at least like, okay, well, that person thinks my kids are cute, so that's a nicer feeling than I felt a minute ago. just a moment of like distance from that total, I don't have any more tricks in my bag for this situation kind of feeling. So it can be something even that simple, I think, as a way of just being like, oh, I see what's happening here. And I know I've, you know, I mean, complimenting someone's children is always a nice move, I think. And it's always a good feeling. So I just think that's a part of it. I mean, that's just a very simple version of it, complimenting someone's baby. But just kind of paying attention when some stranger might be having a challenge with their child, and being able to not intervene in a creepy way or a takeover way or anything other than some like, I see that parenting is hard and I get that in this moment. That's so much more useful to me than somebody writing something nice on Facebook. That's like, it's the difference between, I don't know what the analogy is, but sort of like putting up a poster about equality and justice and like getting to work and doing some stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's a piece of it. It's kind of, it's, you know, like anything else, it is about material benefit and who's okay in a situation and who's not, rather than who do we lift up culturally and who do we not. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think another angle on it is the way that we talk about self-care for moms specifically is about how oftentimes it's about how we deserve self-care so that we can be better at taking care of other mm-hmm. people. Right. Like you can't pour from an empty cup, or even the thing that I say frequently, which was putting on your own oxygen mask before you try to help somebody else with their oxygen mask. Like actually we deserve to have
oxygen,
have the plane not be going down.
Right. Actually, let's try to not have the plane crash. And then everyone should just have oxygen because we're humans and life is short and we deserve oxygen and we deserve a full cup of tea or coffee or whiskey or whatever, because life is short and I don't exist for somebody else, even for my babies, right. who I would do anything for, but I don't do everything for them. You know,
so also like taking a bath is not like treating yourself, it's just right. like hygiene, you know, or right. like drinking coffee uh-huh. or a cocktail. It's just like people have to consume stuff and bathe. Like this, these are not like treats.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what are we, I mean, to the extent then we think about the, what is the impact on other people? You know, I'm raising two white boys and they're pretty awesome, but you know, I don't want to, you know, I have a responsibility to that. That is not just about taking care of them until they reach adulthood. It's actually making sure that they understand that they need to know how to cook, and they need to know how to pitch in and be part of an operation and not expect to be served by a future partner or by anybody. Not, mm-hmm. I mean, then they're doing great in that regard. And their dad certainly models that really, really strongly as well. So that's a really important part of it. Like doing more for other people than is appropriate is actually not good for anybody. And it's not good societally, but that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to
show that we love.
That's right. Kids. That's how we should demonstrate that. Right. And that's how we also replicate all the power structures that there are.
Yes.
We're never in power if we're just enabling white supremacist patriarchal capitalism from like slightly behind the throne, and we're just doing all this invisible work in the background. That's actually, it's not just neutral, it's actually actively harming when we enable that. So not to put more weight on us, but to like do our share, because what that gives us, if we stick in that role, it gives us the illusion of innocence and the illusion of economic and physical security and the illusion of access to power. But it just props up all those systems. Mm-hmm. And so it's not good for us. And it's also not good in the huge picture as well.
And I'd say that that is true in how you relate to your partner, too. If you're enabling those structures to exist within your relationship and perpetuating it, because otherwise you're not, you know, a good partner or supportive, then I carry around a lot of guilt about that. Like, am I just like being, you know, too harsh and whatever, because I'm constantly challenging these things within my marriage. And obviously I wouldn't be married to the person I'm married to if he weren't down for that. But, I just can't not. My thought was something that Mark and I do, my husband, that I really love, and we're kind of trying to do this from an early age with our child as well, is to kind of practice like the growth mindset. So instead of showing gratitude for the person and then describing this person, like this persona, mm-hmm. of like, oh, well, you're so patient and kind and blah, blah, blah. And with that, building up the expectation or a role, we say very specifically what we're grateful for. Thank you so much for doing the dishes, because I was really exhausted after making dinner and watching the kid all day or whatever. So that way you can continue to kind of, just going back to your question about like how to actually celebrate mm-hmm. parents and mothers specifically, maybe taking it away from like the motherhood role and just, you know, what are you doing as a human being that your partner or whoever is praising you admires, and being really specific about that so that it feels like something that the person has actually actively done and chosen, which I always find more rewarding anyway. And then I can think critically about like, okay, do I want to be a person who lives this way, who does these things for other people? It seems like people really appreciate it, versus, now I've been told that I'm a mother who, you know, that I'm endlessly patient. And so now I feel, and I know that that's something that my partner loves. And so now I feel like if I'm impatient, I'm failing at kind of living up to this image that's been created for me.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, let's get rid of all of that. Mm-hmm.
Which was like 99% of like Mother's Day Facebook posts from husbands, and I was just like, I know all of you and I want to personally shake each one of you because you're not babies and you should know better.
Since I can't, I will passive aggressively tag you in the rant I just tried. Yeah. No, I'm assuming you didn't do that.
I didn't tag anybody, no. I just pulled specific words from their posts.
Even more subtle.
Just as a side note, you're literally one of the only things I miss about having a personal presence on Facebook is your rants. So I'll just have to go look on purpose.
Thank you.
I was going to ask, so obviously these are, you know, trying times, or however you'd like to put things. Things are not great. Things have, not to say that, you know, there was a time when everything was peachy keen, but I guess what is both of your philosophy on, and Liz, you talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but on kind of introducing your kids to the world in a political sense. I think a lot of times people think that, oh, you can't talk to kids about, you know, racism, for instance, or sexism or sexual violence or consent, or, you know, there's all these things that people get a little hysterical about involving kids. And so what's your philosophy, and how do you how do you plan to talk to your kids about that?
Well, since you mentioned consent, that's one example that I think is really, that is lifelong. I mean, toddlers are experts in consent. Mm-hmm. Actually, mm-hmm. Yeah. Toddlers are fully exploring autonomy and who is the boss of their body and who is not the boss of anything related to them. And, you know, I mean, my 7-year-old talks about, like, I really think that he needs to clip his toenails or that I need to clip his toenails. But he is very clear that he is the boss of his body. And so we come into some conflict about whether there are some toenail guidelines that need to like be adhered to, even though he is definitely the boss of his body. But, you know, there was a
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, there was just a time actually during the Kavanaugh hearings when one of them was tickling the other and the other one was saying stop. And I kind of lost it and really was like, stop means you stop. And that is not yours. And really did a whole, and they were like, okay, like I was just tickling. And I'm like, I know, but you need to understand that this is really important. And it has been said that sometimes maybe I take things too far, but I disagree. And I think sometimes it's good to, as a mom, I think it actually is a good logic experiment to like think through like what is the consistency here in this situation, like if we think about how does that relate, because I think those connections happen either implicitly or explicitly, and that we can examine them more if they happen explicitly, and I think that's in our interest.
And also your kids are 100% at an age and both have a personality that if your logic isn't consistent, like
they will let me know.
They're going to find out. So,
like,
and it might discredit your whole argument.
Exactly. So. Like Duncan and the toenails.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So I try to, what's more challenging for me is around the idea of innocence and in our culture, who is allowed to be innocent and who it's not seen as innocent and for whom it is not safe to be innocent, particularly around race and thinking about, you know, talking about police violence in this country or wars and the impact on kids in Yemen, you know, for example. I mean, it's just, that is more challenging for me because I know that for my children to grow up innocent of the realities of racism is the essence of privilege for them. And I also, you know, I want them to not be sad, you know? So that's the part where I come up against my own values and standards, because I, you know, it's hard for me to deal with. I also think that as someone who became an activist at a very young age, if we don't have the emotional tools to deal with the realities of the world, it's really easy to get immobilized with despair. And so what does that mean? You know, and how do I offer the emotional tools that I don't always have to deal with the state of the world? Mm-hmm. And maybe what we do is we just hold each other's feelings. You know, maybe we don't, maybe the idea that fixing something, you know, maybe that goes back to my messed up, you know, taking care of others too much idea anyway, that I can only talk with them about stuff when there's a plan to fix it. I mean, there was a day where we showed a film about Afghanistan and I came home and my son asked me what I had been doing. And I said, we showed this film because there's this big war. And he said, well, what is your plan to fix that bad problem? And I was like, oh, honey, we're all really working hard on it and it's a really big problem and I don't have the whole answer. And I probably wouldn't have brought it up if I had known that I would have had to admit that I didn't have the whole answer. Mm-hmm. But actually, that's modeling. Maybe that's good. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
My child is very small, so I'm dealing now more with the kind of personal autonomy piece, which, and she's a powerful personality, so I'm already kind of struggling with the, do I want to teach her to obey and comply, or do I want to like let her know that like that's fine and we're just going to work with it, which is obviously like intellectually my choice, and it's exhausting. So she gets pretty frustrated in situations where she doesn't have a lot of personal autonomy, like physical autonomy, because she's just so used to that. You know, so we're I think there will be a point where we kind of have to talk a little more about, like, well, when you're on an airplane, the standards for behavior are just a little bit different than they are when you're at your house, but we're not there yet. Mostly I can speak from my experience as a child. See, I grew up in my younger years, and we also have some generational trauma around. So I grew up in South Africa until I was like six, and my family saw a lot of crazy things, and my mom had a lot of trauma around that, and I had some trauma around that, and obviously I come from a place of privilege as a white person. I'm experiencing all these things, but they're still, like, very heavy, and they're terrifying, and you know, no matter where you're coming at it from. And then we had some like major family tragedies around suicide when I was young also, kind of tied in with that, that and the abuse cycles and different things that come along with generational trauma. And my parents' choice was basically not to talk to us about it at all, and not to acknowledge that it existed. And so and obviously, like, my mother, who was and continues to be a very traumatized person, was not super excellent at parenting at times that she was dealing with, like, just crazy PTSD and a lot of other stuff. And, you know, the passing of her brothers and all these just crazy things that no human should have to deal with. So I had nobody to talk to about my own grief or my own questions or anything. And the result of that has been that that as an adult, I have struggled a lot. So I think there's, like you're saying, there are some people who can just choose to protect their children from any sorts of trauma, whether they be, you know, kind of like caused by society and structures or just personal things. And I just feel like what I needed wasn't for those things not to happen, but to know that I had a support system. And I feel like that's the best that we can do for our kids, because we can't protect them from everything. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to. I don't want my white child to grow up thinking that this is just how things are supposed to be and never questioning things. And I want her to be kind of growing up with the same passion that I do for, that I have for justice. And to do that, I have to share information for her, with her, that will be difficult because it's difficult to live with. Like, this is a difficult world to live in. Mm-hmm. But being alone with those feelings and those fears and kind of the way that children's minds process, like, there is not kind of always the context, and, like, things that I would get really, really scared about were really just not grounded in reality at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I just was specifically around suicide. I thought that, like, every person who was sad was going to kill themselves, basically, mm-hmm. for, like, most of my childhood, just because nobody talked to me about it and talked mm-hmm. to me about, like, no, like, here's, like, what actually happened, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So I think we can do a lot for kids around just, like, trusting them to have the conversations and mm-hmm. thinking about what's age appropriate, and just kind of not believing that we can keep them innocent.
Mm-hmm. And that there's not just one conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
It's okay to do it oddly in one conversation and then come back to the topic after you thought about it. That's
right. Well, okay. That hour flew by with just us, even without a third person. So we gotta wrap up, but thank you both for everything that you do all of the other days of the year that aren't just yesterday. And
thanks for
Taylor.
Having us.
We'll be back next week with a new show. And if you missed any part of the show and you want to catch the podcast, you can find it online by going to kyrs.org/show/praxis, or by going directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio. There's also links to Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and all the rest of the places on the KYRS show page there. So thanks for listening. You're listening to KYRS 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Kitchen.
A house of Macon, Loretta singing.